Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most of us were taught as children to recognize right from wrong and to do the right thing. Sometimes both can be difficult, but it can be particularly so when it comes to pointing out the wrongdoing of others in government and business and academia, as well as other disciplines. Those who do are often referred to as whistleblowers, and that can lead otherwise well-intentioned adults to treat them the way children react to tattletales, but with far more serious consequences. And that is why it takes an enormous amount of courage for these people to come forward. Often they're simply pointing out wrongdoing on the part of powerful people who are taking advantage of that power, but who can use it against the whistleblower. Sometimes they're pointing out failures or omissions that could lead people to become ill or even lose their lives. But money might be at stake, and that can cause those protecting their investments to lash out at those blowing that whistle. Our guest this hour, Carl Elliott, experienced this personally. He became a whistleblower at the University of Minnesota, where he works. He spent 7 years trying to get an external investigation of a suicide in a research study conducted by their Department of Psychiatry. He was put through the ringer, later to be vindicated, and afterward began to talk to other whistleblowers to figure out how things could have gone better. The result is his book, The Occasional Human Sacrifice, Medical Experimentation and the Price of Saying No. It examines the moral struggle that whistleblowers face, how it isn't the struggle most people imagine, and it examines the toll of telling the truth. Carl Elliott joins us for the hour. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You are a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota, but you started out pursuing a medical career, and you write about some of the things that you were asked to do as an inexperienced third-year medical student in a clinical setting. You were asked to undertake procedures without supervision that you had never performed before on patients, I should point out, and you write about some of the other dubious practices that you witnessed. Was that because of the particular hospital that you worked in, or was that just the way doctors are trained nationwide?
Well, I should say I wasn't just asked to do these things. I did them. And the fact that I did them has stuck with me for a long time, and I've wondered why I actually did that and feel a little ashamed of myself, actually. I do think that the time and the place where I went to medical school, where and when, which was the 1980s in Charleston, South Carolina, we were given a tremendous amount of responsibility, particularly in the county hospital and the VA hospital, where we had, as medical students and residents, had very little supervision. I think it was sort of at the far end of a spectrum of, you know, how these things take place. I don't think it's completely gone away. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the introduction to the book is being asked to do pelvic exams on unconscious anesthetized women who've been prepped for surgery. And I know that still happens because the Department of Health and Human Services felt obliged recently to issue a directive saying you can't do that. And it was kind of felt remarkable to me that this was actually still going on, that you know, that residents and the medical students could actually do intimate exams on patients without their consent while they're unconscious.
And some of the procedures, as you say, that you were asked to do and in fact did as an inexperienced third-year medical student with little to no supervision on this were on live patients, and some of these procedures were terribly painful. Should someone have blown the whistle on that? Has someone blown the whistle on that? Is there another book in this for you?
People have been blowing the whistle on this forever, okay, for decades. It's not a secret. It's just the way things are done. And this is part of the, the motivation behind the book is the fact that whistleblowing is just a very poor mechanism for any kind of moral or institutional reform. Sometimes it works, but usually it doesn't.
Your book does illustrate, and that particular part of the book does illustrate, I think, a problem with the medical establishment. And the title of the book about whistleblowers is The Occasional Human Sacrifice, Medical Experimentation, and the Price of Saying No. So are you signaling a broader problem within the medical and pharmaceutical industries here, and have other industries that you know of taken some of the same approaches that indicate a willingness to take unnecessary, unproven risks?
I mean, you only have to look at what's playing out with Boeing, with their whistleblowers and the resistance to reform, to see that this isn't just limited to medical research. But I have to say, the book, and where I have particular experience, is in academic medical research. I mean, this was the scandal, the research scandal, the abuse at the University of Minnesota that I got involved with. And it's also the issue that the whistleblowers that I talk to in the book are all dealing with. These are research studies, medical research studies, that have gone horribly wrong, that have been done in ways that violate, you know, the law in some cases, but research guidelines in almost every case, and in which someone has spoken out, and very often it has done very little to fix the problem.
And in some of these cases, the medical research that was being conducted, the people involved, knew that it was kind of a bogus study, or they already knew the result of the study. They already knew that whatever they were testing really wasn't working the way they wanted it to, and even the way they were promoting it to, but they kept doing it for promotional purposes, to get credibility so they can get their drug on the market. Is that accurate?
Well, every study is different. And the situation of every whistleblower in the book is different. I mean, in some cases, the research, I would say, at least in one case, the research is actually very good. It led to greater understanding of the disease in question. I'm thinking about the hepatitis studies at the Willowbrook Right. State School, in which institutionalized mentally disabled children were intentionally injected with a hepatitis B and given the hepatitis A virus. That was actually good research. In some of the cases that I talk about, it was terrible research. I'm thinking about the Tuskegee syphilis study, which was, in which 400 poor, uneducated black men with syphilis in Alabama were left untreated for their illness for 40 years by the U.S. Public Health Service. Now, that was a terrible study. Nothing useful came out of it, and yet it continued for decades. And, there was really no secret about that study. It had been published, people on the inside knew that it was taking place, and there were even people trying to get it stopped and failing.
I want to come back to both of those studies, because the first one that you mentioned, the Willowbrook study, which involved mentally disabled children being deliberately infected with hepatitis, is an example of something that probably goes on a lot that might shock people or disturb them, and that is hurting others to help others. And we can talk about that a little bit later on, because I know that you teach ethics, and I'm curious about the ethics of doing something like that. Given much of the whistleblowing that your book centers around, and we'll talk about the people that you spoke with over the course of this, of your own investigation, comparing your experience with those other whistleblowers, how should the average person regard the medical establishment? Particularly, how should we What should we think about? What should we consider if we find ourselves or our loved ones in a position of being asked to participate in a clinical trial?
Well, I would look at it very carefully, and I would look very carefully at the sponsor. I would look very carefully at the clinical researcher, and I would approach it with a lot of skepticism. The reason I would approach it with a lot of skepticism is because I understand the way that research, medical research, is overseen, and it's a very porous, flawed oversight system. I mean, I think a lot of people simply assume that medical research is formally regulated in the same way that businesses are regulated, the same way that an airline or a restaurant or a factory is subject to formal regulation by some sort of external oversight body. That's not the way medical research works. The oversight of medical research is essentially an honor system. It's overseen by committees, usually peer review committees within the institution itself, who decide whether or not the study can proceed. And the oversight system simply trusts researchers to do the right thing. There's nobody, you know, in the lab, on the wards, checking, standing over the researcher's shoulder to make sure that they're doing things as they say they're doing them. The oversight system, the Institutional Review Board, simply trusts the researchers to do the right thing.
Well, we're naive. We've gone through hundreds of years of this, not just in the medical profession, but we're noticing that some of the things that we thought were settled law with regard to how the government works are in fact not settled law. They're just the fact that we have worked on the honor system and have been fortunate enough to have a plethora of honest people who have the public interest in mind, or at least that's what we've thought. There are few guardrails, and the law doesn't seem to be something that that really stands up to those who are going to thwart those norms. Have we been naive in that? Should there be more structure to these things, not just in government, but in medicine?
Well, when it comes to medical research, I think absolutely, yes. I mean, the oversight system that we have now was essentially set up in the mid-1970s in response to scandals like the Tuskegee syphilis study. And in the decades since then, medical research has become an enormous global multi-billion dollar multinational business with a huge amount of money at stake, for one thing, but also academic careers at stake. And I don't think it is prudent or wise. It seems very naive to me to expect an honor system to be capable of, you know, of overseeing that kind of thing adequately.
You're a philosopher, and I guess you look back in time on this, and you're an ethicist as well. So I'm just wondering if the problem is greater today in the 21st century, where moneyed interests are so much greater than they were in the past, or has it always been this way? Have there always been bad actors involved in these various pursuits? And I have 20 seconds.
There have always been bad actors, but I would say the motivation that leads to misconduct has changed fairly dramatically over the past 30 years or so.
Carl Elliott is our guest. He's the author of The Occasional Human Sacrifice, Medical Experimentation and the Price of Saying No. We'll talk about how he became a whistleblower and about the other whistleblowers with whom he talked for this book when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Carl Elliott is our guest. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota and the author of The Occasional Human Sacrifice, Medical Experimentation and the Price of Saying No. It's about whistleblowers, and it begins with his own experience as an unexpected whistleblower, shall we say. Your involvement with all this came from a case within your own university, in the psychiatry department of that university, and a clinical trial that they were participating in with the drug manufacturer AstraZeneca on an antipsychotic drug. And a young mentally ill man, Dan Markinson, was part of that study. His mother did not want him to participate in it. He was psychotic when he was asked to do so, but they put him on the study. Anyway, he took his own life violently, and we don't need to get into gross details, but it's pretty alarming. And you say that all was successfully covered up by your university and by the drug company for several years. You're not in that department, the psychiatry department. You're in the philosophy department. How did you become involved and why?
Well, at the time, I was working in the medical school. I was in the Center for Bioethics, not in the philosophy department. And I read about it in the newspaper just like anyone else. It was there was a series about it in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. I was actually on sabbatical at the time. I was in South Africa. And when I came back, I started asking around because it was so alarming. And particularly alarming to me because, it involved issues that I had worked on and written about for years. I had for several years been on the oversight body, on the institutional review board that, had I been on at the time, would have reviewed this study. And I also had friends in the Department of Psychiatry. And I guess what kind of stunned me about it was that it was such a spectacularly gruesome death that it happened 4 years ago, and I'd never heard anything about it.
I guess we do need to be. Take me through his story, Dan Markinson's story, a little bit. Because you point out that his death was particularly gruesome, which means he was in great psychotic pain to be able to pull this off.
Well, I mean, you've outlined it pretty well, I think. I mean, the difficulty, I mean, the red flags with the study were kind of immediately obvious in the series in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. He was under a civil commitment order. The civil commitment order, because he was dangerous and delusional and psychotic, dangerous to self and others, he was actually threatening to kill people. He was on a locked unit, and he was under a commitment order that legally required him to do what his psychiatrist said. And despite the fact that he was not competent to consent, and despite the fact that his mother was objecting, he was enrolled in this study anyway. And he was discharged from the hospital, again, over the objections of his mother, to a halfway house where he had very little supervision, began to get worse and worse. She became increasingly alarmed, tried everything that she could do to get him out of the study, calling the department, sending emails, writing letters to the department, turning up to the department, and essentially getting no response at all. And she eventually began telling them, look, he's going to kill himself or he's going to kill somebody else. She left a voice message saying this on the study coordinator's voicemail and got no response to it. And 3 weeks after that, he tried to decapitate himself with a box cutter and almost succeeded. These are the kind of things that don't typically happen in a research study, particularly a psychiatric research study.
Did the study continue after that event took place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So nobody really knew about this until somehow newspaper reporters stumbled on it and called you about it in South Africa. And then it kind of surprised you because you knew nothing about it. And as you say, you worked with these people in the Department of Psychiatry. You were a member of the Institutional Review Board that, had you been on it at the time, would have reviewed this study. And then when you came back to the university after sabbatical, you started asking around about this because you just wanted to find out more. You approached people. You say you were met then with eye rolling and sighs and lectures on, quote, the necessity of the occasional human sacrifice, hence the title of the book, on the long, glorious march of scientific progress. That's a quote. And as you write, you'd either seen other charges of wrongdoing covered in the press, like financial corruption, sexual misconduct, academic fraud, but you never got involved. Why did you get involved in this?
Shame. I mean, it felt, I felt embarrassed actually to be working in the Center for Bioethics at a university where this could happen and be essentially unaddressed. There were so many things. I don't even want to, go over them all that were alarming about this study. But one of them was the fact that nobody else really seemed to be that alarmed, at least in the medical school. You know, the administrators that I talked to, not even many of my colleagues in the bioethics center. I mean, the sense was simply, yeah, this looks bad, but what can you do? And I made the mistake of, trying to do something about it.
Yeah, what steps did you take? And as you moved forward in that process, how was that received? This is your employer. Maybe you have tenure. Maybe that works. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But you were investigating your own employer.
Yeah. Initially, I started out, like most people would, trying to talk to people at the institution to figure out how we could fix this. And, what I meant by fixing it was essentially looking at it impartially, having some sort of external investigation. And, after a year or so, it became clear that that was going nowhere. And as it happened, the sponsor of the study during this period, I mean, this was all taking place in 2008, 2009, 2010. The sponsor of the study was being sued by the federal government for fraudulent marketing, and there were documents coming out in that litigation about fraudulent, maybe I shouldn't say fraudulent, studies that had been manipulated and buried and rigged to promote Seroquel, their antipsychotic, that were leading back to the University of Minnesota, to our Department of Psychiatry. And so I wrote about these two strands, the fraud and the death of Dan Markinson, for Mother Jones magazine in 2010, thinking that some kind of national exposure here might shame the university into actually doing something about this. But that failed.
How do you explain that? These are intelligent people, allegedly among the most intelligent people that we have amidst our population, who kind of just shrug it off, didn't do anything about it, didn't take any action. And how do you explain that people who teach and are involved in bioethics also seemed unmoved by this?
That's a good question, and it's hard for me to explain, actually. I don't think it is... I mean, as far as the larger question, the institution, I don't think that that's unusual. This is essentially the response of any kind of large institution to whistleblowing, deny the accusations, stonewall the press, sort of circle the wagons. I think in the Bioethics Center, the general feeling was one of futility. I mean, the response I got was, look, there's really nothing that you or anybody else can do about this. And the response is essentially going to be retaliation, losing funding, the sort of slow strangulation of the center that, that would be sort of leveled in response to something like this. And also the argument that this kind of thing really just happens everywhere. And if I want to take up a cause, why am I focusing my, you know, all my attention on our university rather than one of the other places where this kind of thing happens?
Most of the people who blow the whistle are employees of the entity about which they are telling tales about. And you were certainly an employee at the, and are an employee at the University of Minnesota. What does that feel like? Because it's your job at stake. Maybe you have tenure and that protects you, but other the other whistleblowers that you've talked to, and some of the whistleblowers that have come forward recently in government, at Boeing and other areas, had put their job and their careers, not just their job, but their entire careers at stake. What's that feel like?
Well, to take the steps necessary to blow the whistle requires a certain amount of idealism, I think. I mean, you at least need to believe that if you speak up about wrongdoing, that other people who don't know about it yet will be as outraged about it as you are. And that almost never happens. You think that they're going to be outraged, and they're not really. You think that your colleagues and your friends are going to stand by you rather than the institution, and that rarely happens. And you think that you're doing, you know, what your conscience requires you to do, and you're treated like Judas Iscariot. And all of that leads to a kind of really profound disillusionment, because the entire way that you saw the world, you know, the way that you're, you know, the values that you've sort of built your life on turn out to be wrong in a way. And you feel, you know, you feel a little foolish. You feel betrayed. You feel as if you were incredibly naive at the beginning. And you feel very lonely.
Well, you're a man without a country, and you're out there like a flag blowing in the wind all by yourself. What kind of a toll does that take on you when you're in the moment, when you're still, you've gone beyond this now, but when you're in the middle of it, I don't even know what the question is here. How do you feel? You must feel terrible, but I mean, talk about that.
Well, I mean, part of the reason for writing the book was to try to figure out if other people felt the same way that I did, and whether or not there were any sort of common elements in the experience. I mean, I can talk about my experience, which was, you know, this sense of loneliness and betrayal, but also a kind of obsession. I mean, I look back at, you know, at the experience now, and, you know, I just could not think about anything else. I mean, I thought about the case all day. I thought about what else we could do next to, you know, to get some sort of investigation. It seemed as if everything that we were trying failed, and I just couldn't see any way out, and I couldn't think of anything else.
I want to point out that you were eventually vindicated. Your allegations led to a state investigation that corroborated your concerns. So in the end, you did the right thing. And I think you now know that you absolutely did the right thing, despite the lack of support. But also, you use the first several pages of the book to tell some tales on yourself, which we've already explored a little bit, things that you did as a young medical student that you wonder now, why did you do them? What does that say about you? And it also, you use those pages in the book to demonstrate that it's not your nature to be confrontational. You wanted to show that you have not historically been a vocal complainer. You're not someone on the path to becoming a whistleblower, and yet that is what you became. Are most of the other people that you talked to for this book, were they in that same position? Was it just one thing that so violently struck them that they had to speak out when others did not?
Yes. Yes, that's true. Most whistleblowers are not, you know, they're not activists. right? They're not protesters. They're people who are just thrown in a situation in which they feel as if they have no choice but to act. I mean, there, you know, in some ways, it feels misleading to even use the language of choice and decide, because a lot of people that I spoke to will just say, I had no choice. You know, I had to do it. You know, maybe that's a retrospective view of what has happened. Maybe it actually felt like a choice at the time. But looking back on it, that's the way it feels.
You know, when the public sees a whistleblower because the news brings them to our attention, we either think they're goody two-shoes or they're in the wrong. But you say we need to rethink our whole portrait of who these people are. And you discovered that through your series of conversations that you had with the whistleblowers that you talked to for this book. If they are not the, quote, brave, conscience-driven heroes who risk everything to expose corruption and injustice, and they are not the aggrieved, disgruntled, malcontent who snitches to settle a grudge, then who are they?
They're all different. I mean, that is the... That's the surprising thing. Everybody has a different story. I guess one way to answer that is to look at the epigraph that I chose for the book, which came from one of the whistleblowers I talked to, an oncologist named John Passando, who blew the whistle on a bone marrow transplant study out in Seattle. First time I talked to him, one of the things he said to me was, every whistleblower is an amateur playing against professionals. And maybe the one thing they have in common is that they're all amateurs. I mean, nobody understands what's going to happen when they blow the whistle.
And we'll talk about some of the things that happened to some of the people that you spoke to for this book, what set them off, what they experienced, and what they were blowing the whistle about, and what it all means for the rest of us out here when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Carl Elliott is our guest, professor of philosophy and ethics at the University of Minnesota, author of The Occasional Human Sacrifice, which is a book not just about medical experimentation and the price of saying no, but about whistleblowing around that and other aspects of our society today. How did you choose the whistleblowers that you spoke to for this book? How did you find them?
Well, one of the things that I found, I should say, about 8 or 9 years ago, I started teaching a class on research scandals, medical research scandals. Mainly as a way of trying to understand my own situation at the University of Minnesota and how scandals have played out at other institutions. And one of the things that I learned from teaching that class is that whistleblowers are pretty rare. In most scandals that we look at in the class, doctors, nurses, study personnel, administrators all know that subjects are being deceived or exploited or abused, and they don't say anything about it. And this often goes on for years and sometimes even decades. So I basically just looked at the cases that were exposed by whistleblowers, tried to track them down, see if they were still alive, and talk to them. I mean, I guess the answer is, I talked to the ones that I could find.
How many of them were willing to speak with you because they've been through what you went through, and I'm sure it wasn't a pleasant experience, and it was all behind them when you approached them. It was said and done, and did they want to close the chapter on that book and never open it again? How many of them were willing to talk? How many of them said no to you?
Almost nobody said no, to be honest. I did talk to one person in the book who didn't want to be named, and I talk about that just briefly. There's not an entire chapter to her story. But for most people, this event was, you know, the defining event or one of the defining events of their lives. And, you know, they can't stop thinking about it. So very often they were happy to talk to me, even grateful to talk to me about it, because they've been haunted by it. I mean, some of the people that I talked to in the book are in their 80s. And, you know, the studies that they exposed took place in the, you know, 60s, 70s, 1980s. And they still can't stop thinking about it.
And for many of these people, the word whistleblower will be in their obituary. Is that a good thing or a bad thing in their mind? Is that a bad word? Or did they come out of this experience feeling vindicated themselves, that they had done the right thing?
Actually, that's not true. Most of them will not be remembered as whistleblowers because most of them have not been remembered. I mean, there is one I can think of in the book. Peter Buxton, who blew the whistle on the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. That study is so iconic as an example of the abuse of human subjects that it will not be forgotten. And I think Peter's role in exposing it will not be forgotten, although it is very often left out of stories of Tuskegee. But the rest of them, I mean, these are not people who have become famous or notorious or anything like that.
The Tuskegee story, if people aren't familiar with it, is where black men, was it the 40s, 50s? I can't remember what the decade was. They were deliberately infected with syphilis and then left untreated to see what happened.
Actually, I have to correct you there. Okay. Sorry. Sorry. It is a common misconception. They were not intentionally infected with syphilis. They had syphilis, and then they were left untreated, even though, and not told that they had syphilis, and left untreated in some cases for 40 years, even after the syphilis was easily treatable with penicillin.
You also spoke with the doctor who put the spotlight on an experimental transplant study that killed cancer patients. You look back on something we've already spoken about, the Willowbrook study in which children were infected with hepatitis, a study based on harming individuals who, in an effort to maybe help others. From an ethicist's point of view, I'm sure this happens a lot. I'm sure all medical trials put people at risk in an effort to help others. Is that ethical?
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, there are a lot of things that you need to think about if you're putting someone at risk. One is, do they know that they're being put at risk? I mean, you have to have informed consent. You have to explain the risks. You have to explain them in a way that people can understand them. And I'm going to say all of the cases that I write about in the book, that was not actually done. The other thing is that the risks and the potential benefits have to be in proportion to one another. Sometimes it's ethical. Sometimes it's ethical to put people at risk if the risks are minimal and the possibility of benefiting from a treatment is great. Sometimes people have very serious illnesses that need to be treated. So the answer, I guess, is it's very complicated.
Does it worry you at all that writing a book about all these things that whistleblowers blew the whistle on, and most of them are medical in nature, that you're playing into the hands of this group of people who have come forward now who are anti-vaxxers, who are certainly against the vaccines developed for COVID, but also now would just prefer that nobody get vaccinated for anything. And we know that the polio vaccine has saved millions of lives, that the measles vaccine has as well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you worry that you're giving them fuel?
I don't think that there's anything in my book that should give them fuel, unless, it's...
They don't trust science. They don't trust the medical establishment. And you're saying, why should you?
Well, I'm talking about, I mean, none of the cases that I talk about in the book have anything to do with vaccines, with the COVID
right.
vaccine. I should step back. Actually, the hepatitis studies on mentally disabled children at Willowbrook did lead to hepatitis vaccines. Still, I don't buy the argument that any criticism of medicine should be hedged or should be hedged in, you know, out of the fear that some people are going to misuse it and distort it. I mean, my belief is you got to tell the truth. And if it's misused for misleading purposes by other critics of medicine, you know, I regret it, but I don't feel as if I should hedge my criticisms out of that fear.
There are probably numerous people who know things and believe in their heart, perhaps, that somebody ought to blow the whistle, and they don't blow the whistle. And there are probably a zillion reasons for why, but one of them is a fundamental one. They don't know how. They don't know where to take the information that they have and what to do with it or how to package it so that someone else who's in a position to let the world know can understand it. What is the best approach? How do you get the word out if you see something seriously wrong that you feel needs to be known?
Well, this is another huge problem with the research oversight system, because it's not really that clear. I mean, this is part of the difficulty that we found, those of us who were working on the issues at the University of Minnesota. It's part of the problem that we found trying to get an external investigation of that study. I mean, ideally, you know, where you should go is the Institutional Review Board, which is the ethics board at the institution that is overseeing the study. But the problem is that very often the Institutional Review Board has approved the study, has a stake in what they have said about the study, and is complicit, because they, you know, the members of the Institutional Review Board typically work at the institution where the study has taken place. And very often they're the friends, the colleagues, of the people who have done the study.
So then you need to go to an outside body, and it could be the media, but reporters are not necessarily equipped to understand the intricacies of every single organization and every single clinical study out there. They have no way to vet what you are telling them. So how is there a way to package what you know to attract the attention of somebody in the media who can do something about it and who can quickly understand what it is you're trying to convey to them?
There is, but I don't think that most people who find themselves in the position of trying to decide or, you know, feeling called to blow the whistle know how to do this. I mean, I'm in an interesting position because I've been on both sides of that. I've been someone on the inside trying to get reporters to write about something. And I've also, because I write for magazines, I've also been approached by people who believe that I can help them by writing about their case. And very often, it's extremely difficult to evaluate the truth of what they are saying. I mean, one, it helps to have everything that you are trying to expose documented, you know, on paper and have that ready. It helps to have a very easily understandable summary. And, you know, more than anything else, it helps not to be alone in what you're doing. I mean, this is one of the things that I would want to emphasize, maybe more than anything else, is that trying to do this by yourself is a recipe for self-immolation. It is very easy for an institution to discredit, a single whistleblower. And I was very lucky to have allies at the University of Minnesota, particularly my colleague Lee Turner in the Bioethics Center. It's much harder to discredit, for example, four senior physicians, surgeons, like what happened at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. It is also necessary, I would say, essential for psychological survival, because it is a very lonely road. And if you don't have someone there to confide in, some ally, someone who's going through what you're going through with you, it is extremely demoralizing.
Some people going down this road will find it very difficult. You point out several times that the people that you spoke to for this book, no one would believe them or take their concerns seriously. They were quite often demeaned. If you go down this road and you are not vindicated, if your allegations are not ultimately proven to be correct, that leaves you in a very bad place. And even when you are vindicated, it can leave you in a bad place. You talk about this study in New Zealand, which that New Zealanders refer to as the unfortunate experiment, in which women with a precursor of cervical cancer were deceived and left untreated. For decades, many of them died. It was exposed to the efforts of a man named Ron Jones. In fact, you write, it may never have been exposed without his efforts. And yet you say he seems haunted by his actions to this day. Why?
Well, it's complicated. Part of it, I think, is this sense of disillusionment that a lot of whistleblowers face. This sense that all the things that you thought would happen as a result don't happen. There's the kind of professional isolation, the fact that your friends don't necessarily stand by you. I think with Ron and with some whistleblowers, there's also this sense that you have been disloyal to the institution. I mean, I think with Ron Jones' case, he was very proud of National Women's Hospital in New Zealand. He was proud of his association with it. It was seen as, you know, a sort of crown jewel in the New Zealand healthcare system at the time. And as a result, its reputation was destroyed. And I don't think he really wanted to do that, to be honest.
Would you or others that you spoke to who were whistleblowers for this book, knowing now what you know about the process and about what happens to you in the process, would any of them, would you do it again?
I mean, there's a simple answer to that and there's a complicated answer to that. I think the simple answer is that I, and I think most other people would say, I had no choice. So I probably, you know, in a similar situation would again have no choice and would do it. I think a lot of people would wonder, a lot of people might have regrets about the way in which they did it. The story that most whistleblowers tell is a kind of innocence and experience story. You know, if only I knew back then what I know now. If only I knew back then what this was going to do to me, I would have done things differently.
This is not an uplifting book. Do you hope that it will inspire others, or do you think it will discourage others from coming forward? And I have about 10 seconds.
I don't want to discourage anybody, but it is not an inspirational book. I doubt it's going to inspire anybody. It's a very demoralizing book.
But it is an eye-opening book, and one that perhaps deserves a read. It's called The Occasional Human Sacrifice, Medical Experimentation, and the Price of Saying No. It's about whistleblowing, by Carl Elliott, our author this hour, who is also our guest this hour, who's also a professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.